Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 163rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by Blake Robin and Amanda O'Connor. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Noam Kroll on the show. He is a filmmaker, director, writer, colorist, editor, done all these things.
But blogger, podcaster.
What we found out through this interview, and Matt so eloquently pointed out, is he's pretty much 50% technical and 50% artsy fartsy.
Yeah.
He's kind of like 80% artsy fartsy.
Yeah.
Which is the 50% of for non-artsy fartsy people.
He's like deep cuts. Do you know what I mean? Like, he definitely dropped plenty of names I did not recognize.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, apparently there's some new wave in France.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's
Who
about.
Knew?
I think he appeals. He's like 50-50 exactly down the middle of our listeners. Mm-hmm. I kind of imagine our listeners are like half people that are pretty much their own production companies. They're finding clients, they're shooting things, they're editing things, they're producing things for other people, for businesses, for things. And then he's 50% like just a tour filmmaker, you know. Yeah. Writes, directs, casts, makes, he's made 2 feature films. Yeah, so it's a pretty cool conversation.
You know, he's great on the mic. He's been at it for a pretty long time now. So it's a real treat to sit down with him.
But before we talk to Noam, I want to talk about kicking butts.
Ooh, butt kicking.
Yeah.
All right.
In our May Day competition. May, yeah. May month. May we win.
Yeah.
May the first filmmaking podcast get all the votes. I don't know.
So what Oren is alluding to rather clumsily is that...
thank you.
You're welcome. We are in a friendly competition between a handful of filmmaking podcasts. Making movies is hard. Light the fuse and respect the process to see who can get the most iTunes reviews in the month of May. And the winner gets to write ad copy for all the other podcasts to read for the next month. So stakes couldn't be higher.
Yeah. Regardless of what it means to us, I think it's just another way. If you're not into Patreon, if you're not into, you know, liking us on iTunes, just write a review. Just I think it would, honestly, like on a personal level, just mean so much if you guys can write us a review and help us win this competition. And that, didn't the other podcast say they would quit podcasting if we win? Because there'll be no point for them to podcast anymore.
I mean, I can't imagine that they would want to carry on. But I don't know that that's official. No, just kidding. It would be a bummer if those other great podcasts weren't around anymore.
Right. And just so everyone's clear, the review does not have to be positive. Feel free to leave us a negative review, any review. It's just quantity over quality. Literally, if you're just like, here's your dumb review, Oren.
Sure.
I would love it.
Yeah. At any rate, friendly competition. Write us a review. It'd be great.
And without any further ado.
Yeah, let's do it.
Talk to Noam Kroll. Okay, we are here with Noam Kroll.
Glad to be here, guys. Thanks.
Any
for
relation it. To Nick?
No, but I get asked that probably on a weekly basis. The more famous he gets, the more often I get asked that. But
any
no
relation to Chomsky?
No, typically it's a last name thing.
Yeah, that's not really how it works. But
so tell us what's your deal? You direct, you shoot.
You know, I always say when people ask what I do, so I don't have too many hyphens, I just say filmmaker, because for me everything falls under that umbrella. Mm-hmm. I love business. I love being an entrepreneur. I have multiple businesses now. And I love making movies more than anything. And I love both the art and the business of it. So there are so many different avenues that has allowed me to pursue, which I enjoy most of them. And the ones that I don't, I've sort of filtered those parts out mm-hmm. of my working life. But yeah, now my day-to-day really consists of making whatever passion project is on my plate. So at the moment, it's my feature film we shot a couple of months ago called Psychosynthesis. We just finished the festival cut, so we're submitting that to festivals.
Congrats.
Thank you. Directed.
I wrote, directed, produced. It was very, you know,
the DP also?
No. I had a great DP, Matteo Bertoli, who I was fortunate to have on the project. He just moved here from Italy, and he was actually here just for a month, like literally while we were shooting the movie. And it just ended up working out really well. But yeah, so there's the film side, and then I also have a blog, a podcast, as you guys know, and other businesses. So there's a whole lot that I'm juggling, but the goal is to have all of it really serve my ability to have as much time to be creative as possible and to work on movies as possible. And that it sounds a little counterintuitive because I'm always juggling a lot of things, but I think picked over time sort of found the right things to juggle, so mm-hmm. I can make an income but not kill myself with 80 hour weeks every week and no time to write or edit or direct something.
Well, is it structured in any way, your creative time, passion project time versus entrepreneur business time?
So the only structure I really have is that over 50% of my time, I made the decision quite a while ago that at least 50% of my time has to be dedicated to making movies, whether it's mm-hmm. writing, whether it's editing, being on set. In the past, I had probably tricked myself into believing I was spending more time making movies than I actually was. Mm-hmm. I always considered myself a filmmaker and a director, but when I would actually break down how much time I was spending making movies versus doing corporate work or doing this or that, it was such a small percentage. So now I always tell people my busiest weeks on the business side, whether it's running my business or doing commercial work or corporate work, I have to match that with creative work. So mm-hmm. if I have 30 hours a week of something filmmaking related, I'm guaranteeing myself I'm going to put in 30 more on a film. Otherwise, it's a lot harder to go to sleep at night when I haven't put in the creative work than just spending those crazy hours on certain weeks. Like I said before, thankfully those weeks now are not as common as they used to be. But yeah, it's always trying to find a balance. And you know, to your question, I don't have a very rigid schedule where it's like, okay, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I'm working on my movie, Tuesday, Thursday, something else. It's just trying to be cognizant day by day and make sure that very few days go past where I'm actually working on something creatively satisfying. Mm-hmm.
But what if you have like a corporate job, you're working on it, you know, you're prepping on Monday, you're shooting it on Tuesday, maybe you're sitting in on the edit on Wednesday, and they're kind of all day long. And then someone calls you and it's like, hey, on Thursday, will you come meet with us on this new project for another commercial?
So that's definitely happened. And I mean, my system is by no means flawless. However, I typically, the one thing I'm pretty good at, and I'm bad at many things, but one thing that I'm pretty good at is protecting my own time. So I very rarely have meetings with anybody. I pretty much never have a meeting. This is the longest I'll have sat with two other humans other than, you know, my wife or family for probably years. I just find for me and the way that I like to operate and run my business, it's just not productive. I find a 5-minute email can sometimes save 2 hours of, of, you know, talking in a boardroom somewhere.
Wait, so you don't do meetings?
So not really, no. I mean, I'll do meetings, I'll do creative meetings where it matters. So if I need to meet, let's say, with my cinematographer, but those, that to me is more of a artistic process than, when I say I don't do meetings, I'm talking about the meaningless, what I consider to be meaningless, corporate style meetings where it's a bunch of different people in the room trying to solve a problem that I think could get solved very easily over email or over a quick phone call.
Or maybe you don't even know what problem you're solving. Right?
Exactly. And when you kind of schedule this meeting, you have this feeling that everyone there has to be, you know, the meeting almost imposes a certain quality of the discussion on it. So for me, I mean, like I said, if I have a client that needs me on a phone meeting or something, no problem. If I have to be in an in-person meeting, I'll be there. But I try to minimize meetings as much as possible. I try to minimize any wasted time. Social
media.
What about
like if another filmmaker says, hey, let's go grab lunch?
Oh, sure.
With no agenda.
Oh, that's different. Yeah. I mean, to clarify, that's not the kind of meeting I'm talking about. Like friendly meetings, I have all the time in the world to sit down with friends and, you know, get a coffee or whatever. But I'm talking about like, you know, again, I have a business background as you guys do, I'm sure as well. So it's just, for me, when I say meeting, I'm talking about a business meeting, sitting down, okay, here's an agenda. This is what we're going to go over.
Sure.
You know, let's have these specific talking points, address these issues. It's just
when you're in the more like day jobby sort of filmmaking side.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I think we do, we're lucky in that. I think we both can avoid a lot of that. You'll still have like the big pre-PPM or like, or PBM or, you know, creative meetings. But what I mean is the kind of the circle up of like, we should just be reply-alling to everyone at this meeting instead of just like kind of all bullshitting for an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, it's not efficient for me, at least. I think everyone has their own system, their own way that they like to operate. But yeah, for me, I just find email, calls, short calls, that's kind of how...
That's the move, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, so let me ask you this. So you worked on your film, your feature film, for like a month straight, nonstop. Does that mean you get to do a month of non-creative work?
No, it doesn't work.
And not non-creative work, right? Yeah, more sorry, just like your business,
non-passion.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But I mean, for me, running my business is... As long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, that's my only metric of whether or not I should be doing something. I don't care, you know, a lot of people I think get very wrapped up in defining themselves as I'm a director, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm this, I'm that. People can call me whatever they want. I don't even know what I am half the time. All I know is I have to be enjoying what I'm doing. I have to be putting my time into something that I believe in, whether that's my business or a film. And I'll put, you know, I'll pull 20-hour days for either of those things if I need to. But again, I find, so for me, because I'm a big believer in operating as what some people now might refer to as a company of one. It was so... This book, Company of One, is written by Paul Jarvis. It's a great, great book. Came out, I think, this year. And it really spoke to me personally because I've always been someone who loves business and loves entrepreneurial endeavors, but I don't necessarily enjoy the process of managing people. I like creating systems that are automated. I like working with freelancers, working with other third-party businesses that I can outsource things to, and have ideally sort of benefit from the way that many other businesses operate, but without the same type of infrastructure and red tape. So this book really spoke to that and talks about, I think there's a statistic in there, I may be getting this wrong, but it's something like 70% of US corporations that make over $1 million a year are actually owned and operated by a single person. And some of those are real estate, you know, they're all different businesses. But I've always sort of put that philosophy into into my work. And I've always tried to find ways to essentially have a business or now multiple businesses without having to have full-time employees. I've had them in the past, and I'm just someone who's super hands-on. I'd mm-hmm. rather be working on things or collaborating with people than managing people and keeping tabs and telling them what to do. It's not what I'm best at. It's not what my personality gels with mm-hmm. as much. So anyway, I love the idea of operating in that way. But you guys should definitely check out that book if you haven't.
Company of One.
Yeah, it's super super interesting.
Does that mean I have to fire Oren?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah.
Right, should I? You do. You're fired, Matt.
Oh no!
Yo,
no,
you first.
Beat me. Sorry. Beat me to it.
So the great thing about the book, and for anyone listening, it's not just relevant to someone like myself or like you guys who has a business and works in a creative field, although it does lean toward that. But it even goes to the extent of thinking as a business owner, thinking as an entrepreneur, if you are an employee at a company, and how mm-hmm. you can essentially almost be a company within a company and really leverage your time more effectively. So again, for me, it's always a common thread. I always come back to just protecting my time.
Yeah. I can't wait till you have your kid.
I know, right?
All goes out the door.
Well, I told you, I already built the soundproof pod. Sure. That might only help me for half an hour a day. But
hopefully your wife likes you.
Oh, she does. She helped me build the pod. So, sure,
I thought that pod was for me now. Yeah,
well, right. It might be. We'll see. We can convert it into a tiny little.
Sure. Well, you know what I think is really fascinating to me about this is one of the big lessons we have on the podcast is like learning how people kind of cobble together a career, right? Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be those passion projects. Sometimes those are fully funded by other entities, and sometimes, you know, you just have to self-start on them, right? You just have to shoot it, right? But I think on the spectrum, there's always people who are doing a number of different things. But what's fascinating to me about you is that you have multiple filmmaking businesses, but in unique ways, right? Whereas I think Oren and I will just, you know, shoot some commercials or something like that that's like a little less self-sustaining and a little less, what's the word I'm looking for? You have more passive incomes, it sounds like, right? You've built kind of self-sustaining businesses in that way.
A little Andrew Kramer-ish in a way.
Oh, and yeah, that's a great reference. I learned After Effects through that site. Sure.
I can't wait to meet someone who didn't.
Yeah, you know exactly. What I
mean? But you know, he sells so much stuff. He has a company that makes products. So I have a few thoughts about everything you just said. One is, I love the label filmmaker a lot more than content creator. What we were talking about last week, because it does encompass all that stuff. How do you, Matt, when you introduce yourself to like your parents' friends and they ask you what you do, what do you say?
I typically say director, because I think that's a little easier for people to wrap their heads around. Mm-hmm. They kind of know what that is.
Yes.
Filmmaker, I'm not opposed to, but I guess I just haven't said it. I don't touch many things. Do you know what I mean? I'm a writer director, basically, straight up. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that's what I gather as well, is that although we could all call each other really any variation of these titles, if you're really focused so more specifically on directing, I think that makes it more of a clear distinction. I mean, let me ask you this, because this is a question I always get from people, and it actually came up on another podcast I did. We were talking about this topic of filmmakers that are essentially afraid to call themselves directors. They don't know what point they are allowed, at what point they've earned it. So I'm curious, like, I have my own version of how I like to approach that and how I have approached it, but I'm curious as to if that's come up with you guys. Is that something people have asked you about in the past?
Yeah, it's a topic that people bring up. I feel like just go for it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I'll say most of the people that we've had on this podcast are directors, you know, and that's why when we introduce them, we will say like, they directed this and this is why they're on the podcast. So they're a director.
Sure.
And we have had some guests that didn't want to come on because they felt like they hadn't directed anything recently and they felt guilty mm-hmm. to be called directors. But I think there's kind of either there's one of two ways you can go. One, either you get paid to direct,
yep,
then it's very easy to say you're a director. You know, yep, whether it's like 100% of your salary or 50% or 25%, you know, I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is a little related to what you were saying. It's like, where do you spend your time? If mm-hmm. you're spending most of your time trying to get a film off the ground, making shorts, writing, going to film festivals, film competitions, anything in that world of making your movie, then whether you get paid for it or not, I don't think it matters. You're like a director.
Could be an accountant that also is a director.
Yes.
After hours, I would say you still call yourself a director.
Exactly. Yeah.
The only time I feel like you wouldn't call yourself a director is if you really want to be a director, but you're literally doing nothing to that
exactly.
end.
Exactly. And that, for me, that's the barometer, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, and again, not to always bring it back to the business side of things, but if someone calls themselves an entrepreneur, they can call themselves that to me, and they could be making no money. They could be in debt and failing, and they could be an entrepreneur. They might not be succeeding as an entrepreneur, sure, but they're doing it. They're trying it. So,
and plenty of successful entrepreneurs started out in debt.
Oh,
do you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Oh yeah. You have to fail. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Mark Cuban always says you only have to be right once, you know, it's the more
he would say that
he would, you know, and it's true though. I mean, you try so many different things, and this applies to filmmaking too. And eventually if you stick with whatever you're doing long enough, you get better at it. You get more clients. People believe in you. They're willing to pay you for your time. So for me, when I talk to filmmakers and if they ask me, you know, when should I call myself that? First of all, I'm not necessarily the person to ask. There's no one person that's the judge on that. But my approach to it is, don't call yourself a director until you've actually directed something of your own. Don't say because you want to direct a feature. Don't say it because you want to direct a short. And the only reason I use that, I don't care if it's a $2 feature film that nobody ever sees. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think usually when people ask me that question, it's people who have not really directed anything substantial yet. And I think psychologically, whether it's a subconscious thing or not, what they're really wanting me to say is go just shoot it. Because mm-hmm. when you make that sure. movie, you have earned the right. You can make the worst movie in the world and you're still a director. It doesn't matter if it's good or
you're
bad.
You're just a bad director.
You're just, yeah, exactly.
That's fine.
Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. Let's say you met someone,
hypothetical.
A young person
yeah.
that has 100,000 followers on Instagram mm-hmm. and they do selfie videos shot vertically where they just talk to the camera about what they're doing that day, and then you ask them like, hey, what do you do? And if they said they're a director, would that bother you at all?
Well, that yeah, because I think that is, if they qualified it with I direct social media content or something, then I'd maybe be okay with it. But yeah, I think the directing is by nature a collaborative art form. You have to work. I don't care what aspect ratio it's shot in, but I do care if other people are involved, and if, you know, at least one other, whether it's an actor, whether it's whoever,
then you're directing someone.
Yeah, you have to be directing, and that's something
I would counter. Actually, I think that there's probably incredible films out there that are one person bands.
Sure,
right,
especially
documentary. Yeah. But maybe it's more about the craft or the attempt at craft that we're really talking about.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it. It's the attention to detail. Social media content is live. So again, just the nature of it, not necessarily it lives live forever, but if you go on Instagram and post a story, it's effectively a live experience, even if it's not mm-hmm. actually a live stream.
It's like a video tweet.
Yeah, so there's no ability to do post-production on that. There's no ability to decide between different takes. So once you remove any of the decision-making out of it, I don't know if you can qualify that as a directing job, because if there's one sure. and only thing a director does, it's make decisions.
Well, you can decide what clothes you're wearing, what you're going to say.
This is just a thought experiment, but I would say, if a one-person band had an incredibly thought-through, awesome, single-take, vertically shot Instagram experience that was meant to only be experienced one time, but had, yes. like, you know, an interesting narrative hook and an idea and, like, was planned out and, like, yep. had some theatricality to it, I think we'd all be okay with calling that person a director.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and right. I think there are there are vines, like 6-second vine sure. videos that are probably better directed than a lot of feature films I've seen sure. in a weird way. So I totally agree with your point. But yeah, I see where you're coming from too, because I think what you were probably referring to, Oren, with your question was whether it's if it's someone who isn't focused on the craft and is really just focused on, well, I have an audience. So is that because mm-hmm. you mentioned 100,000 followers or whatever?
Or I make videos. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? At the end of the day, I don't know if there's ever going to be a hard and fast rule. But for me, again, I always think of things from the narrative perspective. I love documentaries. I love all sorts of other media as well. But for me, it always comes down to narrative. And I think the number one thing that qualifies someone as a director to me, besides having actually done something, which is obviously a given, is their ability to work with actors and their interest in working with mm-hmm. actors. And I think a lot of directors, you know, in quotations, directors, when they're starting, they're not actually really interested in directing. They're often interested in camera, visual effects, cinematography, and those are facets of directing. But to me, and maybe I'm just super traditional in this way, but acting is always number one. And I'm the most, if anyone's been on my blog, they know I love cameras, I love gear, I love, you know, every aspect of editing and color correction, all that. But if I could only do one thing, and I could not do all those things, no question, work with actors, throw everything else out. I enjoy it the most. I think it's the most important skill to have as a director. And I think that if you're not focused on that, I don't care what budget you're working on. I don't care who your crew is. I don't care, you know, what festival your film got into. To me, that is the measure of someone who's approaching it, in my opinion, from the right perspective. And that's just me.
But even though, you know, you can talk about like Alfred Hitchcock or Clint Eastwood or Woody Allen, none of those guys are known for talking to actors.
No, but they understood acting. And like someone like Alfred Hitchcock, I'm a huge fan of his. I mean, he is so, so masterful in the sense that he's not going to cast somebody who's not going to deliver mm-hmm. the exact performance that he wants.
But he was also famous for being like, okay, look left, look right, open your eyes, sure. do this, and here's some cold totally. Water, scream, and okay.
But that's, what we need. That's valid. And some actors like that. I mean, on the feature I just directed, we had two completely different types of actors. Mm-hmm. One clearly coming from more of a method approach, one clearly coming from more of a Meisner background, and they need to be spoken to in very, very different ways. I'm sure you guys have experienced
that.
What
a that. Pain to have those two schools represented in a single film.
Well, no, but I mean, it's totally different. I mean, you sure. have one person, and I don't know how much, have you guys taken any acting classes?
We're both married to actors.
So, by proxy.
Have you taken acting classes?
Yeah, in UCLA. I took like in the theater school. But so you
understand the difference.
I took one class that was like acting for directors also.
But that's great. And, you know, I used to take a lot. I haven't taken an acting class in a couple of years, but I'll try to every so often just to sort of sharpen the tools a little bit. And I just find it so fun and liberating and educational, and I feel like I grow so much from learning from actors, and I respect actors so much because films are nothing without talent. And I think actors are often treated as, in a way, especially in lower budget projects, somewhat disposable when you're dealing with, and I'm talking micro budget, I'm not talking about, you know, fully budgeted independent films, but on a micro budget production, everybody is obsessed with the camera. I can't remember who I heard. I think I heard someone on say this on Howard Stern recently. I can't remember who it was, but someone said that, you know, it used to be the actor was the star and that's where the director gave their attention. And now the camera is the star. Everyone's huddled around the camera and the monitor and the actors are not always getting that attention. So, but to your point about someone like Alfred Hitchcock, I don't think it's about the way that someone directs the actors. I think it's about that person making sure that they get the performance that they want from the actor. If that means look left, look right, great. If that means a 5-hour discussion about the backstory of the character, that's cool too. Whatever the actor needs and whatever the director needs to make that work. To me, again, it's more about getting that performance, if you can get that performance, whatever method you use, to me, that's a great indication of somebody who's heading in the right direction as a director.
Cool. I wanted to ask you about where you feel like you fit in Hollywood, because so you've used the word client a lot, which is like a word that I assume that like a Martin Scorsese or Ryan Coogler probably doesn't use that much. Like, I think there doesn't need to be like a specific end goal, but you just talked so passionately about working with actors. And at the same time, you know, have a business that sells LUTs, you know, like they just seem, obviously they're all about filmmaking, you know, different aspects of it. Like you were talking about, you seem kind of like you want to unplug from Hollywood, but also you have kind of these Hollywood aspirations. Are those at odds with each other?
In Hollywood roots in an interesting way.
Yes. Right? So I love Hollywood as a place. I love Los Angeles. From the second I knew what Los Angeles was, all I wanted to do was live here, and I'm super grateful to be here. At the same time, I'm not that interested in Hollywood as a business. I think, you know, I work with a lot of tech companies. So when I talk about clients, without, you know, going through the list, some of my clients, specifically in the tech space, are some of the largest corporations in the world. And when I've worked with those kind of clients and I've seen the way that they operate, the way that they run their businesses, and then I see friends of mine who've come up through the studio system and work in studio filmmaking, I mean, again, anyone's guess is as good as mine, but if I had to put money on which of these systems is going to be sustainable over the next decade, I wouldn't be betting on the Hollywood system as it is now. I love movies. I don't necessarily love Hollywood movies. So if I had the opportunity, you know, people sometimes, you know, look at directors and or ask directors, like, what's your ideal sort of career path, or, you know, what would that look like? And for me, as much as I love the Steven Spielbergs of the world and the Ryan Cooglers of the world, and I admire their work so deeply, that's not ever what I want to do. That's not what I aspire to do. I look at directors who put out consistent work. There's a director, Francois Ozon. I don't know if you know him. Mm-hmm. He did Swimming Pool. That was probably his biggest film here. He's a French director. He'll direct a movie maybe once every year, once every 2 years, and they will, for the most part, from what I can tell, make some money. They're not going to be the next Star Wars, but at the same time, he has total creative freedom. He can take risks, can make movies that you just would never get made on a higher budget. So to me, that's what's exciting. And that's kind of the, you know, the punk rock background. I came up through music and I used to listen to a lot of punk, but, and, you know, I've always felt like, especially at this age, when I look back, that's something that's still a part of my personality, is just, you know, don't do things just for the money. If I was just going to do this for the money or to do a blockbuster level production, which is an impossible goal to even have, I would just be doubling down on my business, because it's mm-hmm. way easier to make money doing so many other things.
Right. I don't think it's about the money, but if you look like like a Ryan Coogler or an Alex Garland or, you know, Ava DuVernay, like, it's not sure. Just because they're making big commercial studio projects doesn't mean they're not excited and passionate about that.
No. And I'm not talking about them. I'm just going back to your question about, you know, if you are, you know, you asked why I refer to people as clients, it's because they are my clients.
I understand that. And I think we've had clients as well, but like,
sure,
we, at least I personally do try to push more towards like, what's a bigger budget I can get for this movie and work with this bigger actor and bigger DP.
It's kind of a funny, you know, we're at a funny, period in time with filmmaking, right? Because fewer and fewer of those $1 million, $2 million, $10 million movies are being made, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of, if you want to make full budget, like big budget movies, mm-hmm. they kind of have to be like big spectacle family films, right?
Yes.
PG-13 movies. And
yep.
So, you know, it's a bummer, right? Because you want to be able to have the resources to take the time to do it right, to do it over like a large scale, to have like a fully fleshed out team and everything, and to be able to do all the previs and mm-hmm. do it right. Right.
But you know, but what about a movie like The Lobster or.
Sure. One of my favorite working directors too.
If you can make commercial films that aren't $100 million.
Take a look at The Favorite though. Right. Like, that movie is pretty cheap. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, dude. Take a look at it. There's a ton of natural lighting. They're not shooting a ton of setups. It's like cool costumes, an awesome cast, and like...
But those lenses, though, are so wide.
They're so wide, yeah.
No, but the cast, I mean, you don't think they're getting like a few million dollars each?
No, I don't think that they're
getting that much money. Exactly, and that's kind of a question I was going to ask to just volley it back to you guys, but when it comes to budget, so for me, when I think of my objectives as a filmmaker, money doesn't factor into it. Yes, if I need money to accomplish a specific creative goal, I would and will go after that money. And I've had opportunities in the past to raise private equity, for example, for my last feature. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do it because it wasn't the right project to do that on. I wanted to have more control. I wanted to experiment more with it. And in the future, when I do that, it will be for the right project, but it'd also be when I need it. So
I've never... Can we stop down for 1 second?
Sure.
How many features have you directed?
So I've done 2 features. The first feature I did was well under 100. And it, for me, again, it's always about what does the film need to get made? And you see movies getting made like High Life. Have you guys seen that? The new Claire Denis film?
No, how'd you like it?
So I haven't seen it. I very much want to see it. I'm a big fan of hers. And you look at a film like that, or you look at a film like the movies the Safdie brothers are doing, you know, and they're working with Robert Pattinson. So sure. That's, I guess, the connection between those two. He's obviously a very well-known star and could have taken a different path, but he's working on lower budget films. So I think, you know, my curiosity
but
is...
But that movie he did... That's not a $100,000 movie, right?
No, of course. But I mean, when we're comparing, for all intents and purposes, you know, a $2 or $3 million movie is the same to me as when you're talking about talent, mm-hmm. $1 million, $500,000. I have
like
friends
like indie versus studio is what it boils down to.
But I have friends, and again, I'm not sure if they would want me sharing these details or not. So I'm not going to say who or which films, but I have several friends that have made independent films well under $1 million, probably under $500,000, with very recognizable talent because they love the script, they love the idea. They're working for $125 a day, and it's a passion project for them because they want to be in something that's interesting. So my whole thing is, you know, if I felt that I could only do something with X amount of dollars and I was so passionate about that idea, I would absolutely go out and raise that money and do it that way. I plan to. I'm developing another film now that very much fits into that category. But if I don't need it, I don't want to spend it. And again, that's just the business owner in me. It's like, it's why would I spend more than I need to create the product that I'm after, you know?
Because it's tiring. Because I've worked on a ton of low-budget movies, you know?
Yeah.
Like the $100,000 movies, the... $200,000, the $50,000 micro budget. When I first moved to LA, that's like all I worked on.
Sure.
And I've done one indie film and one TV movie that had a smaller budget than the indie film, starring Lori Loughlin.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay,
we've got to get in. That'll be a whole other episode.
Yeah.
you know, like our friend Eben, you know, he produced like 3 $250,000 movies in a row, and he's like, that's it, dude. It's like all these favors, all these things, all these permits, and then you're killing yourself. And then the producers are trying to beg people to, and at some point you're like, I just want people to want to work with me, you know, and I want to pay them a fair wage.
Paying them the fair wage is the thing.
You know, and I want people to, and I want to work with the best people in the business. And yeah, if you just did a full season of The Good Place, you know, and now I want you to work on my movie, but you're working with a bunch of like amateurs and you're not getting paid anything, it's hard to convince you to do that instead of spend time with your family.
For sure. Well, I think
again, and once you do have a family, it's like gets even harder to go make that $100,000 film because you're like, I'm killing myself, you know?
Yeah. And well, it comes down to your values. And I hear you. Like I spoke about this on Indie Film Hustle. I did that with Alex Ferrari. I'm not sure if you guys have had him on. But we were talking about when I did my first feature, I literally got sick for like 6 months after. I was, you're laughing, but like it wasn't a joke. Like,
but it's not surprising because people literally are like, You look like Christian Bale in The Mechanic, like at the end of these movies.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like it was intense. But the thing is, what I learned from that was I could not put myself in that situation if I made different creative decisions the next time around. So this time around, I'm not saying there weren't, trust me, like we had all sorts of issues. I don't even want to get into it right now, but it was not nearly as bumpy of a ride. I got 8 hours of sleep every single night. We wrapped early on a lot of days. We had no pickups. It was very smooth. The edit was smoother. I just made decisions that were built into the DNA of the idea and built into how I built my cast and crew. Mm-hmm. And with all due respect, you know, to my crew, they are, in my opinion, they are worth their weight in gold. Everyone is paid well. They may not be coming off of some whatever the hot show is this week, but my only metric, again, is like, what is the quality of their work? I don't, you know, to me, it. I hear you, like, as a business person, yeah, it's nice to have in the PR package that so-and-so was worked on your film and they came off of this show. Or it's nice to have the confidence in knowing that you're working with someone who came off of some huge film. And I hope...
Or even, I mean, when we're talking about, like, $125 a day,
yeah,
you mean, like, a person who's come off a few real films, right? Like a teenager who's not going to hit the grip truck on the side of the house. Oh yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm not you paying anyone $125 a day. You know, that's the other thing is like, I've invested in people, you mm-hmm. know, I put my money where my mouth is. I pay my crew as much as I possibly can without totally going broke. You know, I'll do everything in my power to make sure people are in a good environment. They're well paid, they're well fed, mm-hmm. and you don't need millions of dollars to do that. You just need fewer days and you need creative choices along the way that allow you to not try to make a blockbuster in 15 days. You know, mm-hmm. you can't make those kind of movies. So
was that your shoot schedule, 15 days?
No, 9 days. So we my last movie was 15 days. And the first cut was shorter than this one. It was an absolute nightmare to piece together in post. And this one was 9 days. We had an abundance of footage. It was a completely, completely opposite experience.
So let me ask then, beyond having the experience of understanding what the right idea is, right? Which is invaluable, right?
Like sure.
That is probably really the silver bullet in terms of being able to make a good movie in 9 days, right?
Yeah.
Are there other actionable things that you could recommend for someone else to do? Like,
yeah,
what are your philosophies and strategies to make a movie in 9 days?
Shoot on an iPhone.
Well, it, you know, a lot of it comes down to your creative sensibilities and whether or not it lines up. So for some people, the unfortunate answer is it may not always line up with their vision. So even story aside, if you're just the type of director that likes a lot of coverage, mm-hmm. that's going to be a challenge. I'm super minimalist. My favorite films are often films where there's little to no coverage. Or, you know, what one of my favorite films of all time is called Lore. I don't know if you guys have seen that. It's a brilliant film. It's a foreign film about these children after World War II in Nazi Germany, and their parents were Nazis and they were taken away, and these German kids have to basically trek across the country, war-torn Germany. It's fascinating. Anyway, that film to me is the prime example of coverage done right for my taste. So mm-hmm. they might have a scene, if the three of us are sitting here, where there's basically a master of the whole scene. Maybe the camera's moving, maybe there's some dynamic blocking or whatever. But then there's just these like brilliant insert shots that work and could almost be placed anywhere in the scene to open it or to pepper in. Mm-hmm. And that gives you all the options that you need in the edit, but it doesn't necessarily take the same amount of time as it would to shoot everybody's dialogue from a different angle. Some people would suggest, you know, to your question of like practically what you can do. So number one, I'd say if you're open to little coverage, shoot less coverage, but make sure you still get enough angles that you don't shoot yourself in the foot in the edit. But I think, you know, there's so many other things that you can do if you're open to minimalism. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Or rather, if your idea matches a minimalist aesthetic.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think typically if you have that idea and if your idea comes from a place of minimalism and of simplicity, chances are you probably think that way visually too. Mm-hmm. Maybe not, but most people I know that love tons of coverage, when I see a script that they wrote, there's a lot of moving parts on the page too, because that's probably how their mm-hmm. brain works. So, yeah. You know, I'd say that that's one thing. You know, some people say shoot with two cameras or three cameras. I again, I'm super old school in that way. I like just having one camera and just focusing on the one thing. I'm not as well tuned to work with multiple cameras, but some people would say that that's
I like
an
to
option.
Shoot with what I call one and a half cameras.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me.
So basically one and a half is like when it's convenient, you know, if you're not changing lighting setups in a dramatic way, oftentimes it basically just means stacked. So you're getting two sizes at once. That's handy. But as soon as you're compromising, as soon as you're shooting crosses, right, and your lighting is compromised or your eye lines are compromised to get like that shot reverse shot, that's when it can be a mistake. And it's oftentimes better and faster just to shoot single cam.
That's really smart. I've never heard of that exact approach. But it's interesting because on our film, on our feature, we didn't actually do that, but we kind of could have done that because we had a BTS shooter, basically. Mm-hmm. Someone just filmed behind the scenes, and without telling me, he was actually essentially shooting B cam on a lot of the scenes. I didn't end up using it because it just didn't match. It wasn't on the Alexa, so mm-hmm. the color science was different, and it was handheld for some of it, so it wasn't a perfect match. However, I did think to myself at the time, if we decided to actually do this properly before, I definitely could have used some of this stuff.
Yeah, you could have sniped off some of those great inserts you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've 100%. Had like BTS crews when we're doing like a big, like an explosion or something's falling over or some big stunt, and I'll be like, hey, can you get that like clean without the crew in it?
Yeah.
Just when that happens, just in case. And then I'll tell the DIT to like make sure to get that.
Well, it's sure. smart. That's really like, funny. Why wouldn't you, you know? And I kick myself sometimes even on this film for not doing it, because there was a couple of times when I said, well, it's not going to match. And I should know, I spent years doing color grading and I know how close you can get two different cameras. But yeah, I mean, I just didn't push for it, but yeah. I probably could have and should have, for sure.
So you were shooting Alexa, he was on like an A7S, basically?
He was on Blackmagic, gotcha. Ursa Mini, which is a great camera, but it just, you know, it's not exact. And the other thing is, we shot, the whole movie is framed in 4x3, and he's shooting everything in 16x9, nothing would even be framed properly, really.
I love shooting 4x3 because it makes me feel like a kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's why I did it.
You're like, oh man, it's like backyard home movies.
Exactly.
That's fun.
It brings up another, I'll do another book recommendation. I'm sure you guys have either read or heard of The Artist's Way. Have you guys read that one?
Sure, yeah.
So, and you've both read it or you've heard of it?
My wife
is 750 words.
Yeah. My wife is at like
write the longhand writing in the morning.
Yes.
Morning pages.
Yeah, the morning. Yeah. There you go.
She's been doing morning pages for 1,500 consecutive days.
That's amazing.
5 years almost.
Yeah.
4 years.
Yeah, it's insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I guess for anyone listening, if you're not familiar with a concept, basically this book outlines this notion that, and this isn't actually what I was going to touch on, but it's really fascinating as a separate thing. But you know, you wake up every day and you write 4 pages. It doesn't matter what it is. You could be saying, I don't want to write today, but you just get into the habit. It's about habit forming and about creative flow and just letting your inner critic basically get out of the way. So one thing that really struck me from reading that book was Julia Cameron talks a lot about thinking of your filmmaking or thinking of your artwork as play, as basically like your kid, you're having fun, because that's when, you know, you have a 3-year-old, she's probably super creative in every way. You know, a 10-year-old's going to be super creative. Any 10-year-old is going to have a lot of creativity, but you get older and older and older and people stop learning how to play. They start censoring themselves. They start thinking, well, I would write this script, but maybe so-and-so won't like it. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to get the critic out of the way. The reason I chose to frame this movie in 4x3 is because I didn't want to take it seriously in that way. I wanted to, you know, another expression I love is care enough not to care, which it's another acting thing that I've heard from an acting teacher years and years ago. But the idea was, first of all, I love 4x3 format. I'm a huge like French New Wave guy, and I love old, you know, so many classic films, and my favorites are shot in that.
Have you seen Ida?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ida, oh, Cold War, the new one.
That was 4x3, right?
Yeah.
Black and white, shot on Alexa.
Yeah.
I love both of those, but Ida in particular, so good.
Yeah, Ida is a beautifully, beautifully done film, beautifully shot film. And, you know, so anyway, getting back to your 4x3 point, it was like, or talking about having fun, like, mm-hmm. you know, your kid with your camera. And that's what it was. It was like every time we framed up a shot, it was kind of... not a throwaway in the sense that we didn't care, but a throwaway in the sense that like, this is fun. We're not trying to strive for perfection. We're trying to strive for a fun, collaborative, unique piece of art that we're making. And by imposing that limitation on everything, we had to be cognizant of that every single step of the way. And I think it really helped.
It also forces you to rethink your own aesthetics. And this is true for basically any non-standard aspect ratio. Like as soon as you're not in 16:9, you have to be like, well, why do I think this is good?
Yeah,
you know, like how, like framing any shot up, all of a sudden it's not second nature the way like a 16:9 shot, you can, you know, you do it with your phone nonstop, right?
Yes.
So like just being forced to think through, what do I like about this image? Why am I putting the camera where it is really interesting.
Exactly. And I love when anyone breaks that mold. Like, what was the film a couple of years ago? A Ghost Story. Did you guys see that one? 1x1 aspect ratio. Yeah. And it was perfect for that movie.
He was really just like, Instagram is really coming.
Wait, but didn't he... It's like in a couple aspect ratios, right? Here's the whole
No. That's all 1x1. From what I remember, yeah, it's all 1x1. And, you know, not that everything has to be that, but I find it interesting, and this is another topic that often comes up, that there's more content by far and away made, you know, now, obviously, than ever before. But I kind of feel like there's less, not just on the Hollywood level, by the way, like even on the super low budget level, like there's less experimentation than ever. And at least there, it's celebrated less. So, you know, for example, there's these trends. I did a whole article on this like months ago on my blog about how, you know, we tried to basically circumvent every possible trend on this movie for better or for worse, and knowing some of it might not work, but just in the spirit.
Well, 4x3, I would argue, is a trend.
Sure. Well, you could say it's sort of having a moment right now.
Sure, yeah.
But like we shot in 2K, you know, we shot in ProRes. Like everything I've ever shot before is like raw 4K. Everybody wants 6K.
Yeah.
Has to be anamorphic. It all looks the same. You know, you go on Instagram, you go on Vizco, whatever app you want to use, and look at great cinematographers. And there are, to me, the distinction between a really good cinematographer and a really amazing cinematographer is, are they experimenting and just pushing the boundary? And I think it's really easy now for people, it's easier than ever for people to go through a checklist and say, okay, it has to be, if we have the Kawa anamorphic lenses and we pair them with this sensor, and by the way, I'm all for those lenses, they're great, but you pair, you know, the same lenses everyone's using on the same sensor, and you light it the same way, and you grade it the same way, and you lift the shadows in the same way in post, and it looks good. It's not that it doesn't look good, but I just like something different. It's just my taste. Like, I just like when people try something new, even if it doesn't work. So for me, again, there's probably plenty of stuff that we did that maybe people are going to look at, and some people may love it. Other people may think it didn't work, and that's totally okay. But I can, for me personally, like, you know, again, I can go to sleep well at night knowing that I at least tried something new, even if it fell flat. You know, that's always my philosophy. I'd rather fall flat trying to do something innovative than to, you know, have any sort of guarantee of success. Not that there's such a thing, sort of copying whatever the blueprint may be. So that's just, again, it's just a philosophy thing.
Yeah, definitely. So. And I think you can take that project by project, right? I think there are times when it's fun and interesting to experiment in a more formal way, and there are plenty of times where I think Goran and I both are like more preoccupied with ignoring that part of the equation, right?
Yes.
Like I want the fewest possible things in the way between the image that we're delivering and what I'm trying to make.
Yes.
So like, yep. Let it be 16 by 9 because, of course, just kind of sure. Default standard boilerplate
yeah.
as a way of saying out of the way. You yep. know what I mean?
Yeah. And maybe I agree that like you're not seeing a lot of technical experimentation because why shoot on anything other than the Alexa, you know, and why shoot on anything other than like Master Primes or whatever, you know, if you're doing a commercial. Like,
yeah.
I would argue that I think everything just looks the same because of the quality of tools is so high. That like I was joking about how you could have intercut like the Blackmagic Ursa Mini with that Alexa, and you definitely could, and you yeah. wouldn't notice, right?
Yep.
Like but, some people will, but sorry, I cut yeah. you off, Warren. But
you're not pushing technically anymore because it seems a little hard to keep pushing, right? Like 8K, 10K, whatever. But people, I think where people are experimenting is formats. You know, like
yep.
you do have a show like Bandersnatch or whatever, you know, on Netflix where it's like interactive, or you're yep. skipping years and seasons with Game of Thrones, or you're making shows about shows. Like,
yes. Oh, yeah.
It's I feel like it is a heyday, especially if you look at like the digital world of like experimentation in terms of format, but you're right, not so much in terms of visuals where
yes,
everyone can kind of have that look of the latest James Bond film. So
and we're totally
not pushing anymore.
And I
because you can download gnomes.
Yeah, my love. Yeah,
GoldenEye.io.
I totally agree with you. But my only like I guess counter to that, it's not that there is not experimentation. It's just with the volume of content that we have. Like think about like if we had a visual of a graph of like 1965, like how many movies are made that year versus like 2019, mm-hmm. you know, it would be like a dot compared to the sea sure. of content being sure, made, sure. especially once you factor in streaming and Netflix right. and everything. So yes, you're absolutely right. There are these, what I would look at is like exceptions to the rule where people are, it's not like there's no one else out there that's being super creative or innovative, but it's just that with the vast sea of content being made right now, I wish that was not the exception, but it was the rule. And there were periods of time when I think that was that. I think, you know, the early 90s, I think there was like this amazing renaissance for American independent filmmaking. Obviously, there's, like I said, the French New Wave, there's German Expressionism, there's all these different moments in film history where these amazing things were happening and the format and the medium was being challenged in a way that it never had been. Mm-hmm. And it was being done with like 1/100,000 probably of the amount of stuff that's actually being made. So again, it's not that it doesn't exist, but you know, I'd like to see more of it.
I mean, I think honestly,
what it's not really celebrated.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would argue that there's a ton of really experimental stuff out there. Right, but that because the signal to noise ratio is all out of whack, right? Like mm-hmm. how many films were being made just in general in 1968
exactly.
relative to like, you know, how many mind-blowing, you know, French New Wave films are being made then.
Yes.
Right. It's easier to source those, right? There's less competition to be like, oh, okay, I'm going to go to the art house, right?
Yep.
And so our real issue is that if you've only got so much real estate in terms of promotional and marketing space on iTunes or Amazon or where people are really consuming all of this content, even
yep.
though it's all there in those libraries. Like Amazon has an incredible like library of independent cinema right now, plenty of which is like probably pretty mind blowing. And we just don't even like search for it
yep.
because you don't know to. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think to Amazon's credit, the one thing that I've experienced this actually with my feature. So we had offers from lower tier distributors with this mm-hmm. super low budget. We made the movie for $12,000. It was essentially a no budget movie. And we did get offers. We heard from a bunch of different distributors.
Where did you premiere?
We just did it here at Dances with Films.
Okay.
So we got a screening at the Chinese Theater. Mm-hmm. Literally the whole plan from the beginning was basically self-distribute, submitted to like 8 festivals. It wasn't meant to. Mm-hmm. It's very different.
When you say 8 festivals, do you mean the big ones and then also a few other, or were you going for Discovery Festivals only?
No, yeah, the only big festival we submitted to was Sundance, knowing it was the lottery ticket festival. And then everything else was sort of like mid-tier, mainly just because by the time the film was finished, it kind of timed out that way. It was after, mm-hmm. like even what we sent to Sundance was like super, super early and rough. So by the time we actually had something that was solid and presentable, we were kind of past that like fall deadline period. And anyway, and it was really supposed to be from the get-go an experiment of like, this isn't supposed to be something that we aggressively target festivals with, or we go after these big distributors. Let's make something for nothing. Let's see if we can make some money off of it, figure out how to use Facebook advertising and social media advertising and do it totally ourselves. So even after getting some offers, including one offer, which was very tempting, because this one particular distributor wanted to essentially retro finance the film. So they would have effectively paid the money back right off the bat. But then they would have been an equal partner. But anyway, even after all was said and done, we decided let's just put it online. Let's see what happens. It's now on many different platforms, most of which I've actually advertised for actively. The one platform I've never advertised for is Amazon, and it has performed far better than any other platform, not only on terms of Prime like streaming, mm-hmm. but also in terms of the actual literal like independent purchases as a transactional VOD platform. Mm-hmm. So I think the reason is, you know, Amazon takes what people refer to as the long tail approach.
Sure.
So they're all about like, what's the 95% of movies that everybody else is forgetting about? And iTunes isn't promoting these movies. Netflix isn't buying these movies. So that's where their sweet spot is. So, you know, not that it's perfect, but I think they're the closest thing that we have to a good discovery platform for these like no budget, micro budget movies.
Yeah. Fascinating. Can I ask, did you make money?
So yeah.
I mean, did you edit it and color it and do the sound mix and this?
I did everything. I did everything, but I love doing it. That's the thing. I love doing it. You know, I'm fortunate to have a great business. And at the time that I shot that film, I actually was just launching my second business. And yeah, I could have forked over the money for a sound designer. I could have had another editor come on board. But my rule of thumb is if it's something I like doing or something that maybe I don't like doing, but I can at least learn from the process and I haven't mm-hmm. tried it once myself, then I'm gonna try it, you know? So on that film, like I've never done sound design before. I did it on that film. I realized I actually like doing it. I'm proud to be a jack of all trades. I love knowing sound design. Like I love being able to open up After Effects and move the keyframes around and animate the title sequence. Like it's not that I want to do that on every project. On my commercial projects, I certainly don't do that's where I literally often just step in as a director or as a producer. But on something like that, it was like, that's my wheelhouse. It's like,
what's fascinating to me about you is that I think that we all kind of create like archetypes in our heads of like different types of filmmakers. Right.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating to me about you is that you're both artsy fartsy, right?
Yeah. French New Wave, come on.
Which I don't mean pejoratively, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I know. I love
minimalist, you know, foreign cinema, all that, right? And also hyper technical.
Yes.
Which is an interesting combination that I think is rare. I don't know that we've had that on the show so much.
So, well, that's interesting. I guess no one's ever quite put it that way to me, but I think
no one's called you artsy fartsy and hyper technical
individually, yeah. but not in the same sentence. But it's true.
You're a hippie nerd.
I am. So I think the reason why that's happened is I've actually growing up, I was never a technical person. I remember, you know, I always think back to like in high school, if the TV wasn't working, like I didn't even know how to like plug in the cable box into it. Like I had to call my brother to help mm-hmm. or something. And over time, I realized that understanding the technical aspect of the craft was tremendously liberating creatively because I was able to do more myself. I was able to work on things that still I could make look, to my opinion, look great mm-hmm. without having to hire people that I couldn't afford to do mm-hmm. those things.
Yeah, sure.
So it wasn't that I grew up like loving the technical. Like I,
it's
said,
just a DIY thing, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think the real thing to lament, just in terms of the industry, is just that there's no middle ground anymore, mm-hmm. right? Like yes. micro budget indie is still incredible and really thriving, right? Like I think the quality level in a certain sense has gone up just because cameras are so accessible that you can get a GH2 and get an image out of it for, you know, with $10,000 is incredible. And then, you know, big movies are big movies are big movies, but it's that like middle range of your $10 million comedy that's just, or $30 million or $50 million that's just gone away, basically.
It's true. Yeah. And I think where that's frustrating for me is it's gone away not only in terms of the financing of those kind of movies, but also in terms of the exhibition, because there are still movies like that getting made, but those are more so competing with movies that someone like me is making for $10,000 than they are competing with the $200 million franchise film.
Sure.
Because a lot of those, and maybe not like the $50 million movies, but you know, a movie made for $2 or $3 million, it's, right. it's rare that that's going to get any sort of theatrical release unless it's very limited. So there's not all that much of a difference in terms of the actual exhibition of it, which is both, it's kind of this dichotomy where it's kind of good if you're starting and you're making no budget movies because you're on the same level in a sense in terms of your ability to share it with other people. But it's very frustrating when you do reach the point where you want to grow out of that ultra micro budget range and you do want money, because at the end of the day, investors, you know, it's like the age old thing, and everyone in Hollywood that you meet will tell you, like, it's easier to raise money for the $200 million film than it is to raise $500,000, because what investor is going to believe that they can make any sort of ROI on a $500,000 indie, you know?
Yeah. Why would you think that you could even make a movie for that much?
Exactly.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a weird time, but I do think it's changing, and being the optimist that I am, I think what we'll see more of, and I hope to see more of, are a couple of things. Like one, we're seeing some filmmakers now not crowdfund, but crowd invest in their films, mm-hmm. Which is very interesting.
Sure, there's WeFunder now. Have you seen WeFunder?
Oh, I've seen that platform.
Very curious about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Help me buy another Wii. It's been a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, someone I had on the podcast, Jim Cummings. Have you guys had him on?
Yeah, yeah. I've known Jim for a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, we probably had him on way before you had him on.
Yeah, probably. So
we had him before the feature, but after the short.
So he's doing that, from what I remember from our discussion. I think he's basically raising money through some sort of like crowd equity, you know, and mm-hmm. and I think so that's one thing. But then the other thing and the other angle that people take is,
and that's legal, because there used to be a time when that was like,
yeah, post Obama actually, like now he changed some specific the rule basically that kept people from being able to crowd invest.
Yeah, when I was
in like
raising
2014
money for my first feature, I was like, why don't we just go on Craigslist and say, hey, who wants to invest in this movie?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, do not do that.
Yeah, yeah. It used to be illegal, and now through like the Trade Commission is legal. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can
sites
do that. Like WeFunder.
But yeah, you can also do what you guys are doing or what I'm doing. It doesn't have to be building an audience around filmmaking, but you can have what, you know, the well-known article that we've probably all read, 1,000 True Fans. I'm blanking on the name of the writer now, but it's a short article. Yeah, you can pull it up, Oren. It's a short article that essentially makes the case for
Kevin Kelly.
Yes.
The Technium.
So it basically makes the case for you no longer need a massive, sure, massive, massive audience. All you need is 1,000 people who will basically buy every single thing that you release, which means you'll probably have another few thousand that are surrounding that 1,000 that kind of like your stuff, and another 10,000 that maybe like it. But if you have that 1,000 people, and every year, you know, they're going to spend, you know, $100 on whatever mm-hmm. you're doing, like that's a six-figure salary from those 1,000 individuals, and you can build that community around a shared interest.
Right.
So,
which in LA is like still below the poverty line, unfortunately.
Yes, but in the rest of the world, I mean, it's not. And you know, that's also a launching off point, and that's sort of the basis for a lot of people. It's like, you don't want to rely on making, you know, I think most people want to grow and want to change. Mm-hmm. But if you're starting from a place where you're making $100,000 a year, and you know, for us living in LA, we may get a little jaded, but most people probably listening to this podcast, you know, are working super, super hard to make that kind of money or to not make that kind of money. So like the idea of being able to connect with a relatively small group of people that really love what you're doing, you can create something that they value and they can support your work. Like, you guys have a Patreon, right?
Sure.
So, I mean,
I think also it's important to think about, though, that $100,000, that's gross. That's not net.
Oh, right? Yeah, of course.
So,
by the way, also, I'm throwing out the $100, that's off the top of my head. You may have a product that sells for $500. You may have a product that sells for $1,000, you know, so, and
it's, or $99.99.
And even if you need, you know, 3,000 people, you know, and you're making $300,000 a year gross. So like 3,000 people is still like 1 in 10 million people or whatever it is on the planet. So if 1 in 10 million people doesn't like what you're doing and is not interested in following what you're doing, then maybe something's not quite, you know, clicking yet. That's my philosophy. And I think everybody, like, no matter how specific your interest may be, no matter how subgenre your taste may be in films, there's people out there that are kind of interested in it too. Sure. You know,
yeah. We talk about our viewership a lot and the numbers, which, you know, are pretty impossible to like
very
pinpoint.
Difficult, especially with podcasts. The blog is easier, but yeah.
But one of the interesting things, is that through Apple Podcasts, iTunes Connect, I think it's called, you get the average listening time per episode.
Yes.
And ours is like usually hovering somewhere around 62 minutes. So we tell people, great, like, you know, regardless of how many people are listening, like, they are listening for a very long time. It's not like a YouTube video or a 30-second commercial or something. I mean, people are investing an hour into listening to us drone on.
Oh, boy.
No. But that's the thing, is they get to know you guys, your personality, your work, and they value that camaraderie. And it's like, you look at someone like Joe Rogan, who has if not the top, you know, podcast, one of the top probably three. And what I do know, though, is that, you know, 100 million people are listening to his podcast, right? So he's doing something right. And I do know that someone like him with that platform, it's like, it's not about the guests. Like, it's not like when I listen, I'm a huge Howard Stern fan. Like, I've listened to him since I was like, you know, too young to be listening to him. And when I listen to his interviews, even though he's arguably the best interviewer ever, in my opinion.
Ever?
Not you guys are better, obviously. Yeah, okay, cool. He's number two to you guys. But yeah, three, I mean, like, you hear his interviews and they're fascinating. But at the same time, I tune in because it's like, I know Paul McCartney's on, or I know it's whoever. It's a filmmaker.
Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think, I think it's interesting when you talk about the length of, like, view listenership or whatever for your episodes, because it has a lot less to do with your guests probably than it does with you guys, which is a testament to what you're doing and
we pride ourselves podcast. With you being the exception, is getting guests that aren't famous.
Oh yeah. Oh, well, if I'm considered famous, then we're all in a lot of trouble.
But we try to get we talk, what do we call it? The middle class of directing.
Yeah, basically.
They've worked on things you've heard of, but you don't know their name.
If there's a mission statement, it's that.
Well, we should probably wrap things up.
Yeah.
All right.
At the end of our show, we do endorsements, unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements. I like to endorse things that probably 99% of people know about, but this is for that one percenter. Something I've been using a lot over the holiday weekend. We celebrate Passover and Easter, and there's a lot of driving around Southern California.
Sure.
Everyone knows about the Google Maps set reminder feature, right? Remind me to leave.
And remind me. I
don't think I've used it. I've heard of it, but I've never used
basically,
it.
Basically, so I know I need to be at my parents' house in Yorba Belinda tomorrow at 6 p.m. And I'm trying to schedule something for tomorrow morning. I want to know what time I need to leave. And because the traffic right now, at least in L.A., has absolutely nothing to do with what the traffic will be like tomorrow. So I can set a reminder and say, I want to be in Yorba Linda at 6 p.m. And it will say, and I think of driving to Yorba Linda as like a 50-minute thing, but it'll say like, oh, I'm going to remind you at 4:20 to leave because there's going to be a lot of traffic tomorrow. At that
is
time.
This in Google Maps?
Yeah, but what's annoying about it, and I guess why it's even worth mentioning, is because it doesn't say like it, the name of it isn't show me how long it will take tomorrow. And when you're looking for directions, you can't set arrival time. You have to choose remind me to leave, and then it'll ask you either what time you want to leave or what time you want to arrive. And you can say what time you want to arrive and it'll calculate backwards.
Interesting.
When it should tell you to leave your house. And it's totally accurate. And it's it, for, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but for a place like LA where traffic can make the difference between a 30-minute drive and a 2-hour drive.
Yes.
It's like really useful. And over the weekend, we just used it a ton and it was awesome. We got everywhere more or less on time.
On time.
But we would have been like hours late if we hadn't used it.
Crazy.
So set reminder to leave. And once you click that, it'll ask you what time you want to arrive someplace. And then it'll calculate how long it will take there at the time you're traveling.
That's brilliant.
Based on, you know, historical information like Saturdays on this date or whatever in this month.
So smart.
Summer break
so
or spring wild. Break. It knows there's a lot of algorithm going on.
Awesome.
Okay, Matt.
Rad. Well, so mine's a two-parter. The Criterion channel just launched relatively recently. It's a real treat.
It's on a cable channel?
No. It's on another streaming service. The thing that's interesting about it is that, to me, it's not a true like replacement for Netflix, Hulu, and all those other streamers, right? To me, it represents kind of the new style of streaming services where it's about curation. Do you know what I mean? It's not unlike Mubi in that way.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think that we're going to see more and more smaller channels, smaller subscription services with a smaller subscription fee that are just repurposing library content and showing you like, hey, this is just the thing that you should have gotten around to watching, you know, years ago. Here it is front and center and it'll be gone in, you know, 2 months or whatever. Like Mubi has like their
Mubi 30 days.
30 days. Yeah, exactly.
And but how much does it cost?
It's like you can do the annual rate. They were just doing like a special based off of like relaunching it because it kind of came out of when Filmstruck went away. So it's like I think like $130 for the year, something like that. Not crazy. But the thing that's awesome about it is that they'll curate lists that are really handy, whether it's kind of like stuff that you've never gotten around to or linked with current events. So like, for instance, the obvious one is like they have an Agnes Varda like playlist and it's like, oh, that's awesome. She just died relatively recently. I don't know enough about her. I haven't seen her stuff or maybe I want to like catch up. That's the place to kind of see those sorts of films basically. And so that's a real treat. I've been digging in on that, enjoying it.
And so people still watch movies, you're saying?
Yeah, every once in a while they do. And then also, I broke down and got a new Apple TV because I've been watching everything on my PlayStation, and Criterion Channel wasn't on PlayStation. So I was like, okay.
And it looks pretty nice, right?
It's awesome. It's
someone,
like,
was it on our podcast where someone said that Apple TV Netflix looks way better than like any other version of Netflix?
Somebody I've noticed that too. Yeah.
It's just like, because I had like a first generation Apple TV. And so the thing I really missed was being able to put stuff from my computer up on my TV. Like screenplays, actually. It's like if you ever need to collaborate with somebody, that's the killer feature for me of an Apple TV. It's just AirPlay onto your TV is awesome. Right?
I love it. Yeah. I use it all the time.
But that new 4K Apple TV looks so good. And also it does such a good job of like integrating all of the different services that you have. So you can kind of just browse everything. You're not thinking like, oh, I need to go to HBO for this or Amazon Prime for that.
Well, remember for the longest time, Amazon and Apple were fighting. So there was no Amazon Prime on Apple TV. So I had like a Fire Stick set. It was like a whole thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Now it's all over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Criterion Channel and Apple TV. Pretty great.
Awesome. Cool. And I'll second your Mubi. I've got something else, but it's funny because I was thinking about that too. I recently came around to Mubi, which is brilliant. If anyone hasn't tried it or downloaded it on your Apple TV, it's basically every month there's 30, I think every day there's a new movie.
Yeah. How do you spell it?
Mubi. And it is 30 movies a month. They come and go. And it's just, it's kind of a refreshing alternative you know, to any other streaming platform or most other streaming platforms, because you don't have to sift through 10,000 movies to find something that you like. It's kind of curated for
you. Here's the good thing to watch today.
Exactly. It takes the guesswork out of it. But we've already kind of gone there. So my other thing, and it's going to sort of almost be the opposite of, not quite the opposite of Oren's, but on the other side of the technology coin, is I always wrestle, you know.
Love getting lost and being late.
I do. So I have an app that takes me to the wrong location. No, but I find when it comes to being creative, and again, that's always my like biggest goal when it comes to like protecting the time or whatever. It's like, I need the time to be creative. I need the mental awareness to be creative. And I spend a lot of time because of my blog online, whether it's on my computer, on social media, on apps, on my Apple TV, like I'm always plugged in. And I've been...
Do you want to guess, Matt, what he's going to endorse?
Yeah, guess.
I have no idea.
Can you
Freedom?
Guess? No, I don't know. Is that an app?
Yeah.
Okay, so no, I've tried those.
It's been
so,
endorsed many times.
No. So I've got something probably takes it a step further, which you guys, I'm sure maybe have heard of, but it's called the Light Phone. Have you guys heard of that?
Oh, I've heard rumor of this, but do you have one?
No. I don't have it yet. I just learned about it and I'm waiting. They have a second version coming out. So I'll explain what it is for anyone that hasn't heard of it. So basically it is the anti-smartphone. It's literally a dumb phone, but that is... supposedly that works extremely well and efficiently. Mm-hmm. It has just what you need on it. It's super minimalist, super basic design, just white or black. You can have text messages and phone calls on the second version. I think on the first one, you can even do texting. And I believe the first version was paired to your iPhone or to your smartphone. So you could kind of decide, you know, which day, if you want a bit of less of a digital, you know, interference in a certain day, you can just take that as like your emergency phone.
You're going to go to the coffee shop to write, you take that phone.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
And so I haven't ordered one yet, but I'm certainly going to. I just have gone down a bit of a rabbit hole of looking at, there's another one called Punkt, P-U-N-K-T. And then there's a couple other ones, but the Light Phone.
Ashton Kutcher just laughs at you when you buy it.
Yeah. But the Light Phone, if it does what it says it does, so I can't endorse it 100% until I've actually used it, but if it does what it says it does, I will very likely convert to using it, potentially getting rid of my iPhone entirely. And that doesn't mean getting rid of social media, but that does mean that I'll be able to, and I've already done this. I deleted Instagram from my phone, even though I still use it. I deleted Twitter. But what happens for me when I delete those kind of apps from my phone is I stop using them as a consumer and I start using them as a business person. So mm-hmm. I use Hootsuite, for example, to automate my social media tweets, and I can monitor them that way. So by not having them on my phone, I'm not every 2 seconds checking and updating and getting pulled into this, you know, feedback loop, dopamine hit garbage that they're feeding us. And you know, I'm as big a victim of that as anyone. So I started with deleting the apps, but I do want to take things a step further and try that Light Phone. And hopefully if we do another one of these episodes, I'll tell you guys if it actually was decent.
And it has GPS too, which is cool.
Yes, which is huge, because there are some things like Waze. I use Waze all the time on my phone. It'd be tough to...
Your phone makes your life better.
Yes.
We just are addicted to the parts that make it worse.
Yeah.
Right? Well, so no email in this Light Phone, right?
No. And I mean, I check my email. I respond to my emails, unless it's an emergency, at most twice a week. And again, it's...
Wow.
It's, yeah.
Twice a week?
Yeah. So
wait, you check your email twice a week?
No, I'll check it daily, but I respond twice a week, because 99% of emails that I get, not even including spam, just emails, they're not time sensitive. And when they, most of the time, if the sender believes they're time sensitive, they're really not time sensitive either. So I do a lot of weird stuff to get technology out of my life, but at the same time, I rely heavily on technology for my income. So it's this bizarre situation I've found myself in.
Yeah, incredible.
Nice. We did email you on March 29th, and you responded on April 2nd.
Yes. Look at that. There exactly. you go.
Yeah, so if
emailed
anyone
you on
listening,
April 3rd, you replied on the 4th.
Yes.
We're figuring out his patterns here.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so that's my very bizarre promoted unpaid endorsement.
Unpaid endorsement.
Yeah, so...
Well, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was so much fun, and it's cool to be here and meet a couple of fellow filmmakers. So hopefully this will be the first of many.
Well, where can Just Shoot It listeners learn more about you?
The hub of everything is just my blog, noamkroll.com, N-O-A-M-K-R-O-L-L, because nobody really knows how to spell Noam, other than maybe Oren. Noamkroll.com, and I have my podcast, Show Don't Tell. I also have a color grading platform called Cinecolor. So it's Cinecolor, CineColor.io. And that will be, there's going to be a new content stream coming there soon. Right now, it just houses some of my cinematic creative color correction LUTs, but I'm launching a whole other blog and content stream dedicated to color grading. So if you guys are interested in that, can visit that as well, and social media stuff at Noam Kroll basically everywhere. So that's pretty much it.
That's cool. Awesome.
Well, your listeners can find out about our podcast at justshootitpod.com. justshootitpodcast.com.
Both work, but justshootitpod.com is kind of the handiest one, and we're on all social media platforms at justshootitpod.
And we interview filmmakers about, you know, working. It's kind of the craft, where craft meets business, kind of exactly what we talked about.
Absolutely.
And people, we try to have people on that make their living or intend 100% to make their living through filmmaking.
That's awesome. Again, thank you guys. This was so much fun. Yeah,
thank
you. I really appreciate you reaching out and making this happen. This is awesome.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, you can find out more about me and like what I do at directedbyoren.com. I'm on, Instagram, O'Kaplan, right?
Yeah.
Sorry. And,
it's a running joke. I feel like you've got a mental block on it now.
Yeah, well, because in a couple ways I'm Oren Kaplan.
You can find me at MrMadenlo.com or on all social media at MrMadenlo. Nice and simple. And you can find out more about the show at JustShootItPod.com.
If you have any questions or comments, email us at JustShootItPod@gmail.com. Leave us an iTunes review. That would be great. We got to talk more about that.
Yeah. This episode was edited by Jay McCullough. Thanks so much, Jay. It's produced by Madeline Rosewatt. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to right now is by the artist Jazar, provided by the Free Music Archive.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.